Going Linux, episode 445, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill.
Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and open source applications and using them to get things done.
If you want to send us feedback, you can always email us at goinglinux@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-904-468-7889.
In today's episode, listener feedback. Hello, Larry.
Hello, Bill.
Thought I'd beat you to the punch that time.
Yeah.
So,
how you been doing?
Good. Let's see. Quick weather report is finally cooling off. We were out of the triple digits, and I'm very happy about that. Kids are back in school. Roads are busier. That's about it.
Yeah, weather report here, still in triple digits, wish it would go away. It will soon. Okay.
Okay.
We've got lots of feedback this time around, and I have to say it's mostly from Sean. He sent us a series of voicemails that we've been collecting over the past month or two, and we've got a five-part series, actually. What did he say? So it went to part three, and then he added a PS, and then there was a follow-on with one more thing, and then we have a separate message that he left just for Bill. So why don't we start with those, and we'll make comments on each of these parts as we play them. How's that?
Yeah, I listened to all of these, and then read through the transcripts of them, and I think that we both kind of pulled out some of the main topic ideas that he's wanting to discuss. So I think we should go ahead and listen to the first part one of six and go from there.
Yep, sounds good.
Aloha from Utah, Larry and Bill. This is your number one pandemic minion, Sean NZ17 Robinson, with another enthralling voicemail message, or possibly dull depending upon your interest, but let's just pretend it's awesome. Anyway, I listened to your recent episode, and I have to say that I have a few things that I'd like to mention. First of all, Larry, would you mind going and posting the show notes alongside the episode's audio when you post them to the Internet Archive? I like downloading your episodes from the archive. However, there's no notes alongside them, so it's just a basic page with the MP3 and the Ogg Vorbis file and whatever else is generated by the Internet Archive automatically, which is good. However, it'd also be nice to have the show notes, even if it's just a simple copy and paste of the text, as sometimes, especially when I'm using older web browsers that can't go to the Going Linux website because of its current website certificate, so the old browsers don't trust the new cert, so the SSL TLS connection fails, I go to the Internet Archive to download the episodes, and, well, there's no show notes there, and the actual show notes page is just one long, seemingly endless web page of notes for dozens or hundreds of episodes. So it can be a bit unwieldy for slow CPUs or machines with small amounts of memory to render. So anyways, long message about that short. Please post show notes to your Internet Archive file postings of the episodes. Thanks. Anyway, back to the topic of the episode, which is applications. And so, a few things. One, the Blender application, which most people know for 3D animations, and a few people know can actually be used to make computer games, can also be used for video editing. So there's another option for anyone interested in that, especially those that already know how to use Blender. Another option, audio players. You guys mentioned VLC and how there's some audio / music players for the command line. And a few that I've tried and that I would recommend is VLC's various command line or terminal interfaces. One of them is ncurses based, so it's more like a GUI application where you can use like arrow keys and other shortcut keys like you used to in media players.
Okay, Sean, your idea of posting the show notes in Internet Archive, I haven't thought about doing that. What I have thought about doing is putting our website in more of a blog format where each episode has its own page so that you don't have the issue that you have with slower computers not being very quick about rendering the very long show notes page. So let me take a look at how much work it would be to put the show notes in the Internet Archive. It's just one additional copy and paste, I think, when I post the episodes there. But we'll take that under advisement and see what we can do. Certainly, revamping the entire website is a lot more work than copy and paste every time we have an episode. So we'll take a look at that.
Didn't you hand code this, our website, to be... I thought you had done it hand-coded to make it so it was a lot faster, not a lot of bloat.
I did. I took out a lot of stuff, but as it turns out, the show notes page contains all of the show notes, I think, back to episode one.
Oh, wow. Well,
and
okay.
It's all one big long list.
Yeah, so I can see where Sean
is a section. Yeah. For modern computers, that's not a problem, but for older computers or where you have a slow internet connection, that can be a problem. So we'll take a look at finding a way to make that better one way or another.
Okay.
And if that is posting the show notes for each episode to the Internet Archive, so be it.
Okay. That's a good idea anyway, to have them archived up there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
All right. He also mentioned something about Blender being used to make computer games.
Yeah, well, it's 3D animation, and not only can you make movies, you can make video games, apparently, so or computer games, if you want to call them that. But either way, that's an interesting use.
I think there are some people that use Blender in some of the bigger studios for, like, rendering certain scenes or something. I'm not quite sure. I know it's powerful enough, but... I know I've heard that some of the movie studios were using it for something. I don't know how true that is or not, because you know they have some pro tools that I think would probably be better, but it's because it's just made to do one thing. It's super expensive, mm-hmm. So I can see them trying to use Blender if they don't have to buy a license.
Yeah, and. You know, splitting up the work, I'm sure that if you split it up to several computers running Blender, it's a lot less expensive or just the distribution of work. You can get through it a lot quicker than trying to do it all in one monolithic program on a super expensive Mac computer or something like that. But the other thing Sean goes to talk about in this particular segment here is the use of command line for doing some of this work. And he mentions that Blender has command line, VLC has a command line, and we'll see in some of the other voicemails that he leaves, he talks a lot about the command line. And I just want to give a definition of a term that some of our audience may not have come across. So if you're new to Linux or new to command line, you may see that the term ncurses is used, and that is a way on a text-based terminal of giving you a graphical way of interacting with the program from the terminal. So it's not exactly command line, when you're using the NCurses interface, but it is terminal based. So that's what he means when he says NCurses.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I know we don't do a lot with the terminal or command line because we're kind of aimed at the new user. Mm-hmm. And whereas sometimes you can do things a lot faster via the command line, I find that I just use the GUI, and you'll hear that term. And just to explain that, that's a graphical user interface, just like Windows or Mate or any of the others, KDE. It's the interface that you usually use to get things done on the computer. I don't think it's a bad thing, but I don't think that's something that someone moving straight from Windows to Linux is totally interested in. Basically, they want to be able to do their daily work and get it done. You know, a lot of times people will start picking up some command lines. Some people will find, oh, I kind of like this. But mm-hmm. as a general rule, I think we try to stay away from the command line because it is, the command line is super powerful and it can do a lot of stuff really quickly, but it's not necessary to get things done. It's something they can explore on their own.
Right. Yeah, especially since we're focused mainly on the new user. But there are some very powerful programs that only run from the command line that we could talk about. So as we go along, maybe we'll include some of those in some of the episodes we have. But I wouldn't hold your breath waiting for them. We'll talk about them as we run across them and find them interesting to talk about. And specifically, if we think they might have some value for a new user.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify. When we say new user, we also mean just regular users too. Someone that's been using Linux, but is just, you know, wants to see if there's something better they can use. So we're more geared to just the new user, normal user, if there is one of a Linux normal user, but people that want to use it to get things done as far as with their work or play a game or watch a movie.
Right.
That's what we are trying to do, is to get them to use Linux.
And our definition of a new user isn't necessarily somebody who's new to computing. It could be somebody who's been using Windows for 10 or 15 years and is fed up of all the hassle you have to go through to install things and to keep it secure and to reboot every time something happens and try to find drivers for things and not sure whether or not it's safe when you download it. All that stuff goes away when you switch to Linux. And our objective here for that kind of a user is to show how easy it is to switch, how similar it is in some ways, and how different it is in terms of your experience, because you don't have a lot of those hassles. So that's what we define as a new user. And whether you're switching from Windows, which has been around a long time, the Mac, which also has been around a long time, or from something like Chrome OS, if you're moving from school and your school forced Chrome on you and you found that it was not, a full-fledged operating system in the same sense that Mac, Windows, and Linux are, then moving to Linux might be a good option for you.
All right.
Let's move on to part two. Let's listen to Sean's next section here.
Okay.
Part two. VLC has both this NCurses-based interface as well as a command line, like a true command line, one command at a time at bash or whatever shell you're using for your command line. Both of these are good. Another one that I like to use, which has both GUI and command line interfaces, is Timidity, the MIDI music player. So if anyone likes sequencer music, like you used to have with computer games 30 years ago, or even fresh music from today. Timidity is really good for playing MIDI formatted music, and it has a TK user interface, GTK, I believe. Another one is a curses-based interface, command line, even a dumb interface where you just start it up and it plays whatever you told it to. So those are good. And another one is MPD, which I believe is the Music Player Daemon or Daemon. And that's just a daemon or daemon, though. You might want to use Music Player command. That's for the command line. It's included with Debian Linux. And there's another one called NCMPC, which I believe uses the ncurses library for a graphical user interface at the command line. And these are really good, especially because when you quit the client, the daemon will keep playing the music in the background if that's what you want. So you can just have it playing music back there without you having to pay attention or spend the resources on it. Anyways, other than that, I'd really like it if you guys could perhaps spend some time reviewing some command line programs, preferably with curses user interfaces, as I find that's an excellent combination of being resource light and still being user friendly, because you still get a GUI. It's just made out of, you know, ASCII text characters or colored rectangles or whatever. So it's intuitive for those used to using arrow keys and the enter or return key and other shortcuts like that without having to be as basic as, hey, here's a command line tool, read the manual or info page to figure out all the command arguments.
For the part two, he mentioned that the VLC has like the ncurses based interface. That's the... Am I thinking of the same program? I haven't used VLC. That's the one that you can pretty much throw any video audio file at and it will play it.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, just checking because I was like, is there another VLC? I don't remember it ever having a ncurses based interface. So shows you how much I pay attention.
Well, and of course, VLC underneath the hood is using a lot of command line audio and video processing that is native to Linux as well. So you could go even deeper if you want to use the command line and bypass VLC altogether and do this stuff for yourself using those tools. But eventually you're going to want to automate some of the commands from each of those tools, and eventually you'll find yourself, if not duplicating, then having some redundant functionality in that automation that's already built into VLC. And yeah, so some of this stuff, you could go so deep that you would not want to be a new user and even think about it. And VLC has the ncurses interface to allow you to do this from a terminal, which you can do if you want to. And if you want to use a graphical user interface, it has that as well.
Yeah, I do want to point out he in one of his statements, he was going, telling that like MPD, which he believes is the music player. He goes Daemon or mm-hmm. Daemon. It is Daemon, mm-hmm. but I like Daemon better.
Yeah,
that's the reason. Only reason I know that is that FreeBSD has the little devil thing, a little cute devil, I think that's,
yep.
And it's daemon, so daemon is basically a process. So right. But I like daemon too, so I think daemon, it should be called daemon, because some of the times it can be demons.
And I don't know about you, but I've never heard of NCPMC. Maybe because we're not in the command line a lot.
Yeah, I never heard NCMPC. Then again, there's a lot of things I haven't heard of. All I know is I download VLC when I need it and just use the graphical interface and let all that magic happen behind the scenes. That's my way of computing. I don't need to know all the different things. I mean, I know some people like to dig in. Oh, it uses this part and this part. I'm like, if it works, I can get my stuff done, I'm good.
Okay, so part three is on computer games. So let's listen to what Sean has to say about that and a particular computer game called Icebreaker. Here we go.
Part three. Anyway, Bill, you were talking about computer games, and one of my favorite computer games for Linux is called Icebreaker. It's a game featuring a bunch of penguins on a grid-shaped playfield. The playfield gets divided every time that the player clicks somewhere, subdividing and subdividing into smaller squares. Meanwhile, penguins are skating across the ice, and if they touch a wall that's currently forming to divide the playfield, it will break that half of the wall that the penguin collides with. This is based on an older, famous computer game. However, my mind is blanking on that old computer game's name. Anyways, it's a classic form of gameplay, a classic gameplay genre, and it's a lot of fun. It's free Libre open source software. It's resource light. It's included with most Linux distributions that include games, as far as I know. It's charming. It's simple. It can be enjoyed by anyone of any age, basically. And it's an excellent time waster for when you've got to wait for something, or if you're just playing something for fun, or heck, you even have a file downloading and you've got a minute or two. Anyway, it's an excellent game. It keeps track of your high scores, and I think they even have a client for Windows, if anyone still uses that operating system series. Well, I think that's been just about enough for this voicemail. Hopefully, you guys can perhaps, I don't know, review a few email clients. I know I like that Clawsmail client. I haven't used it for years. It was good, though. I generally just stay with an older Thunderbird client that I like well. You know how it is at Mozilla. They're always making changes and cutting out useful features and changing the UI and icons. If I say if it's not broke, don't try to fix it. You'll probably just make it worse. Right. So I guess everyone take care. Thank you for the episodes. I look forward to the next episode of Going Linux. Hopefully we won't have such big breaks between episodes next time. So from your number one pedantic minion, this is NZ17 saying aloha from Utah.
Okay. Well, thanks for describing how Icebreaker works. Bill, as the resident gamer between the two of us, have you even heard of Icebreaker? Have you played it?
I have.
Anything about it? Okay.
And? I think I played that thing. It's been around for a while. If I'm thinking of the right one, it has the little penguins and let me think here. It's been a while, so I know it was a charming little game, but it was not exactly to my taste. I preferred a little bit more depth, but it's cute. Yeah, you have the penguins and you have to get them, I think, across an iceberg or something like that. It's been years since I've played it, but it's cute. Small children would have a great time with it. Or if you're just sitting there, just want to, you know, chill and just, you know, mindlessly play a game, it can be fun and distracting. So I've played it, I believe it, because there's several different ones. There's one that you actually I know it's not this, it's where the penguin of you know, taking down a slalom, and I know there's open bubble and stuff like that. So there's a lot of games. I wouldn't call them AAA games, you know, compared to like some of the games that I like to play, but they are good and they're built in and they're made with love. So you know, you can't really,
yeah,
you really can't go wrong. And the price is right, and you can tell that whoever made them put some love and attention into them. So, yeah, and they're maintaining them still. So, can't really complain.
Yeah, so sounds like kind of one of those mindless time waster kind of games, which I like those.
You would. Yeah. I get bored of them very quickly. I need something more, action-packed. But
the rare times that I game, I definitely prefer the action-type things. But I'll tell you, every once in a while, if I have 5 minutes to spare, I find myself gravitating towards this kind of a time waster.
That's called solitaire.
That's a little too but pedantic for me.
But, you know, when he says it has a grid-shaped play field, I wonder if we're thinking mm-hmm. about the same game. I'm going to now have to go look in the repositories and download it to see if this is the same game I played a long time ago. But, well, thanks, Sean. Now you put me to work. Jeez.
Yep. Now you did it. We're going to have a game review next time. Anyway.
All about Icebreaker.
Yes, there you go. Okay. So he also in that one mentioned about email clients. He mentioned Clawsmail and Thunderbird, other Mozilla related things. And, you know, there are a number of email clients you can use, of course. The one that comes with most of the Ubuntu-based distributions is something called Evolution these days. And Thunderbird was popular amongst all Linux distributions at one time or another in the history of Linux. So most people who have been on Linux for a while will certainly know Thunderbird. Clawsmail seems to me, I've tried that out. It seems very old and creaky to me, but hey, I'm sure it works. So lots of choices. So we're not going to get into that too much, but yes, there are incursus-based email clients and even just plain old text-based email clients for the command line. So, lots of choices, and we could spend more than one episode just reviewing email clients.
So I want to, make statement on this, the email clients, where he did point out some good incurses based in there's Thunderbird and etc. But with everybody carrying a smartphone, the email clients aren't as, I'm not saying it's for the better, but the email clients are now web based, cause yeah. Everybody wants to keep track of all their email throughout the day and not just at their computer. I'm sure you can install something on your phone if you want. But I found that most people, when you ask what their email address is, you remember when it first started, the internet service provider would give you a email address. And that was your email address. Now, you've got MS. Well, I have an MSN and a Gmail, and I have one for work too. But they're all web based, so I can look at them while I'm at work or I'm with some friends or whatever. So I don't know if email clients are as big as they used to be. They do have a place for people that don't want to have their data stored on the big companies or everything like that, but it I don't think it's as prevalent as it used to be of having a email just set up. I mean, has to support POP and has to do all this. So that's why I think you think Clawsmail feels a little creaky. I think you said creaky.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It used to be email thing was big, but now I see most people just use the web based. I'm not saying it's a better alternative. I'm just saying that's where the seems like the technology has went.
Yeah, it's more convenient for sure. And as you know, we have a Gmail account here, And it's, I check it using, using the web. Even when I'm sitting at my computer, I don't go through the routine of starting up a client based in Linux and having it download in the background the email so that I can read it. It's just faster and easier to just open up a browser, click on the shortcut to Gmail and go read it and respond and be done with it, you know? And yeah. The same thing with the phone. You can have that exact same experience on the phone, and I do.
Yeah, I do a lot of work on my phone just because it's always with me. So I think that's kind of taken away some of the things that you would do in email. You remember you used to be able to type it out and save it, and you can do all that on the web now. But it's nice that you have options if you want to. If you still want a traditional email client, you can do it. You can set it up where it will work with the web-based services. It's just, but with regular users, I mean, I know I don't have any confidential or anything emails that I really care if anybody sees. But if you do, then of course you'd probably go with the one where it's, it can only be downloaded on your machine. You don't use a web base. So there's use cases, but most normal people, especially coming from other operating systems, are just going to continue using the web base. I was actually helping an older gentleman at work, cause they use, we use 365, Microsoft 365 for work. And it's a special hospital edition. You know, it has to meet all the HIPAA stuff. And, basically, he had a hard time just figuring out how to check his email. And once we showed him, he said, oh, okay, it's just like home. Yeah, it's just like home. So I think it's trained people to just use the web-based.
Yeah.
Whether it's self-hosted, like in big corporations or by big companies. So, yeah, you kind of have to give and take. I'm not saying one is better than the other. I've run both ways, and like you, I pretty much just pop open my Gmail or MSN or my work email web-based and go from there.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, well, enough on that, I think. Although Sean said that was the end of his message, he couldn't resist. He had a PS. Let's listen to that.
PS. Okay, I guess that was almost the entire thing. Two things. One, I would like to humbly request that you guys review some live USB Linux distributions, preferably ones that keep a persistent home directory or persistent installed applications. I've been using an older distribution of Puppy Linux recently, and it's good. However, perhaps it's just too old of a Puppy Linux distribution because the persistent home directory and installed apps feature is just not quite there. I've tried the Debian Live USB, but that was like 10 years ago, so I'm not sure how good that is these days. As some live distributions will run from CD or DVD or USB, and they don't have a persistent directory, and some have a persistent home directory or root directory, and it maps the file systems and layers to integrate what's included with the pre-built distribution image as well as anything you've installed or downloaded. Some will run the pre-built part from USB or CD, and some will have the live directory on the CD or DVD if it's rewritable or USB. Others will keep it all on one medium, so like everything on the DVD or everything on a USB drive. Anyways, there's a lot of options out there, so I'd like a little insight and guidance about this topic, if you would.
So he said he would like us to review some live Linux distribution, USB Live.
Right.
And I know Ubuntu has it, or they used to. I haven't used a live USB with persistence for a while. But I believe Ubuntu, you can make it like that. But that's the only one I really know of. That's the only one I've really used. How about you?
Yeah, I've used Puppy Linux, and they have a version where you can, you know, put it on the USB stick as a live distribution of Linux and have it remember your saved data, whether that's email or whether that's something else you've done. So basically you're running it from a USB stick as though it were installed there, even though it's a live version. And I have actually, for some lightweight distributions, gone and downloaded the installation image and installed it on a large USB. I have a USB stick that's, I think, 128 gigabytes, and there's enough space on there to install a full Linux distribution and use it just like you would a regular installation, as though that USB stick were a hard drive. Now, there are some disadvantages to doing that. USB sticks are not meant to be used in that way, and so they might die earlier than a regular SSD drive or even solid-state M2, I think it is, drive, whatever that is. And so you've got to be a little bit careful that your whole, you know, Linux may go away as the USB drive dies, but it's a handy way of being able to carry your computer around in your pocket, you know, in something that's the size of a USB stick. So that's one way of doing it. Rather than even use the live USB stick with persistence, which is the equivalent of this, just get a big enough USB drive and install it on there. So yeah, give it a try.
USBs have dropped in price quite a bit. I mean, I think the smallest one I have is a 64, but I just bought a 128 gigabyte one from ScanDisk, one of the mm-hmm. better ones, and I think I only paid like $20 for it. So
yeah, you can get some really large size ones for a decent price now, decent compared to what it was when they first started making them.
You know, remember back in the day when you'd go and they'd say, here's a USB with all my stuff on it. And it's like, great, I got a free USB. And, oh, it's 2 gigabytes or, oh, wow. Now it's like 2 gigabytes. I'm like, really? What am I going to do with 2 gigabytes?
Yeah, you can't even put a live distribution of Linux on there. You can't burn it to that. It's not big enough.
No, yeah. It's like, why are you cheaping out all these? Get some better ones, you know. But no, seriously, I do carry a USB with me, but I only use it to store files. I don't use it, you know, like paperwork, documents, pictures, or I want to share with someone. Sometimes it's just easier to say, here's a USB with all the pictures. Have fun, you know, type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the smaller ones are cheap enough. You can just give them to the person.
I don't need it back. I keep it.
Right. I think the smallest USB stick I ever got was at a conference somewhere. They handed some documentation for something on this USB stick, and when I opened it up, it was 64 megabytes.
How did we live with
this? What can you... Yeah, I know. I think my first hard drive was that big, 64 meg.
I had a hard drive that was 10 meg. What are you talking about?
Oh, that's right. I do remember the 10 meg hard drive. We're too old, Bill.
Hey, I'm just... For us old timers, see if this brings back memories of all this. It is DOS. Then you had to install Windows 3.1. Then you had 3.11, and they were separate. And you had to do some. Remember those days?
I do. So
back in the Stone Age,
and DOS 6.0, and then you had to go to 6.2 or something, and the Windows, certain version of Windows wouldn't run on the older version of DOS, so you had to get the updated version.
Yeah, and because, but for those that didn't have the joy of installing just DOS, DOS stands for Disk Operating System. Just so you know. So when next time someone says, what's DOS stand for? Now you know.
It was a special program that just booted your computer is what it was.
So you could install the operating system. It was an operating system. It would do all the low-level stuff. I know there's some people who say, I'll never leave DOS. DOS can, I can do everything in DOS. I kind of think of it like, you know, people, the ones that refuse to have any graphical user interface on their Linux. I'm only a text-based. You know, that's it seems that it was back in DOS too, but you would install DOS and then you had to make sure that the Windows that you had, now this is before I even knew about Linux, would, you know, like you said, was the correct DOS. And then wasn't there a, I think that IBM had their own, or I know there was also one called, I actually run it a long time ago, OS2 Warp from IBM.
Yes, that one, yeah, that was from IBM. That was
A
whole different program.
Yeah, a whole different, yeah. And it didn't work in with certain accessories. I remember installing OS2 and warp, you know, it was warp speed. The only problem is it didn't support the WIN modem. And for those that don't know what a WIN modem is, you have to, it was where it was a cheap version of a modem that required Windows to make it work. That now we were talking, we're talking about the dial-up days. Nostalgia kicked in.
Yeah, exactly. And we could go on and on and on, but we won't. We'll spare everyone that. All right. And not the last voicemail from Sean, but the second last one. It's a one more thing kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And let's listen to that.
The last thing that I'd like to request is you guys were mentioning how you use Discord these days to record your podcast. Well, I have my own podcast, ASO Radio, or ASO Radio. It's about Japanese animations and comics and video games from Japan. And we used to use Gizmo 5, but then Google bought it and killed it because they just wanted the back-end infrastructure, I guess. And I've been looking for a good client that lets me record multi-party conversations like you, Larry, and Bill have, right? So if you could, I'd appreciate you letting me know what you use to record your conversations. Like, does Discord have a built-in feature for recording the audio? Or are you recording the audio a different way with some other software? I noticed that Puppy Linux has a SIP, S-I-P client, and Gizmo 5 was also SIP, like Akiga.net is SIP. And so I was thinking of using this Puppy SIP client because apparently it has built-in recording functionality. I also wrote a command line script, though, to record all of the Pulse audio streams to record the input and output streams. However, I'm not really too sure of what's the best option, I guess. So if you have recommendations for SIP clients or things that can record audio, I'd really appreciate that. And I look forward to hearing what you guys have to say. Thanks and goodbye.
Okay. I've got to remember to put a link to Sean's podcast on our, in our show notes so that people can go listen to that if they want to. So we'll do that. And with that in mind, basically, Sean, we don't use Discord to do our recording, although we could. Most of the video conferencing software and most audio conferencing has switched over to video conferencing as well these days. But a lot of those tools have the ability to record typically you end up with one big file with everybody's voice on there, so it's difficult to edit. If somebody has stuff going on in the background, you can't just flat out cut that section out because you're cutting out the person who's speaking because it's all one big audio file. So we don't use Discord. We don't use the video conferencing software to do that because of that kind of thing. And I know things are progressing along with some of the video conference software that actually split speakers out into different audio files. And if that ever gets to be something that has a lot of polish and provides some advantages over the way we do it, we might consider using that. But the way we record is we use Discord for Bill and I to hear each other and have a conversation, but we don't record on that. We record on our own computer hard drives using Audacity as the recording software. And then Bill puts his file in a cloud location that I go and pull down. So I have both his recording and my recording on my computer. And then I use Audacity to edit the two together in separate WAV files or separate audio files or separate audio tracks. And then when I save them or export them, I export them as a single audio track, MP3 file and an OGG file, and post those to Internet Archive and point our feed to the recordings there. So that's the behind the scenes on how we do the recording. And that seems to be the most efficient and effective way to do it, quite frankly.
And one of the features that we both use on Audacity is that Audacity lets you save the file as an OGG, an MP3. I think you can save it as a WAV file, and there's several others. I think a FLAC. Does that FLAC too? I always save mine as OGG. But you can tell it what quality level you want it to save it at. But with some of these other, if we were using Discord to record it, there's only a limited amount of options. So it gives us a little more flexibility, especially when we want to up the quality or make it not quite as high fidelity. Because at one time, Larry, remember you used to have a low bandwidth version.
Yes.
And you would have to save at a lower rate to make it fit. What was it, 64K? Was that it?
It was 64K, and Internet Archive generates that automatically now.
Oh,
so
no, you don't
have all to do I work. Would have to do, I don't do it this way, but I could just upload the MP3 and upload the OGG, and the Internet Archive generates a 64 kilobit version that would be acceptable. It wouldn't have all the, you know, the album art and the other stuff that goes along with a normal MP3, but which is why I don't do it that way. I upload a 64 kilobit version that has the artwork in it. Mm-hmm. And that, so I still provide that, so I actually export three files, but
oh, okay.
You know, it's one extra click. I'm not worried about that.
All right.
Okay. So our last message from voicemail message from Sean was actually recorded sometime after his series that we've just reviewed. And this is specifically for Bill. Here you go.
Okay.
Aloha from Utah. Hello, Bill and Bill. This message is for Bill. Bill, I was wondering, have you tried the QBitTorrent client? It's a very good BitTorrent client, and it's cross-platform with Linux, Windows, and other OSs. It's my favorite BitTorrent client and has been for the last few years, so I recommend that everybody give that one a try. Next, Bill, I was wondering, since you have to use Windows at work, and I don't mean X Windows, have you considered or would your workplace allow you to use an alternative shell like OpenShell so you could avoid some of the Windows annoyances? Or is that not an option? Oh, by the way, based on your recent podcast episode, I felt I should call in and say that hard disk drives do not use needles to read their magnetic platters. They use magnetic heads that have metallic arms that are suspended in a low friction gas to spin at thousands of rotations per minute, just above the surface of the platters to read them. So needles would probably be a really bad idea for your data. If you keep this up, Bill, Larry might have to cut your pay in half. And you know, half of zero is going to be a lot less. So keep that in mind. I mean, this is NZ17 saying aloha from Utah.
All right. So have you used Qubit Torrent?
No, I didn't even know about Qubit, but I am going to check it out. That's for sure. Since it's cross-platform, yeah. That's definitely, it would come in handy.
Yeah, we'll have to go find a link to that and put it in the show notes.
And then he was saying, he was wondering, since I have to use Windows at work, and he doesn't mean X-Windows, is funny, have I considered, would my workplace allow me to use an alternative shell like OpenShell so I could avoid some of the Windows annoyances, or is that not an option? That's not an option. Yeah, I work for a healthcare facility who has very strict internet policies and computer policies. Everything has to be run through IT. I'm not even allowed to. I don't think I can. It's locked down where IT pushes out all the updates. They control what you do. It has to be HIPAA compliant. And HIPAA has a bunch of stipulations for patient privacy and stuff like that. And basic healthcare information. So anything that it's on the computer, that's what you're allowed to use, and you're not allowed to muck with it. They don't even want you to turn it off unless they tell you to. So, yeah, they are very strict. I know some workplaces might allow you, but not in a healthcare. Now, what about you, Larry? Would they let you use a different shell, or are they pretty strict on you guys too?
I haven't tried, because if I want to use a Linux shell, I just open my own personal computer.
Yeah.
Since I work from home, it's not like I have to bring my personal computer into work in an office somewhere. So that's not an issue. I will let the company have whatever rules they want to have, and I'll use the computer that they provide me in the way that they suggest. And they do, though, allow us to install certain utilities if we need them to ensure that our home office works properly. So, for example, they provide a VPN with a workaround so that it's probably not a workaround. It's probably I don't know a lot about how VPNs work, but it allows me to connect even when the VPN is connected to my home printer, so that I don't have to worry about printing, getting off the VPN to print something and then go back on the VPN to access anything from the company. It used to be that way, but they figured a way around that, and now I'm able to do that. And I use Synergy and Barrier to be able to use a single keyboard and mouse so that I can, from that single keyboard and mouse, move between my personal computer screens and my work computer screens. And it's just one big multi-monitor computer to me. When I want to use Linux, I move the mouse over to the Linux monitor. And when I want to use the operating system for work, which happens to be Mac, I just move the mouse over to that screen, and away we go.
Yeah. So he also mentioned something. I don't think I said this, but he seems to think I said that the hard drives use needles to read the magnetic platters, and I know they don't. They use magnetic heads to read the platters, so I don't know where that come from, but if I did, that really is a old man mental block there. But yeah, unless we were talking about vinyl records, which I've had before, but
that
no.
Could be. Yeah, you may have been making a parallel to the way a vinyl
that could
record
be.
Where,
yeah, but
you know,
I know
record
that
player works.
But yes, you know, Larry has been talking about cutting my salary again because of all the high inflation. So Larry, Sean says that you should go ahead and cut my salary in half.
Yeah, it was an honest mistake, Bill. So we'll keep your salary the same as mine. We'll keep them both at zero, and we won't worry about cutting salaries for, you know, until inflation takes over so much that cutting a zero-based salary in half will actually have an impact on our not for any sort of money business.
So I just saw that it looks like NZ17 or Sean is in Utah. You know, this October I'm planning to go to Moab, Utah. So,
okay.
Hey, if you have any
ideas. See all the colorful rocks.
Yeah. And, hey, guys, if you have any great places, yes, I'm selfishly plugging this. Please send them to me so while I'm down in Moab, I know I see some cool stuff. Okay. Moving right along.
All right. Well, thanks, Sean. Besides Sean's voicemails, we actually have two emails as well. First one is from George from Tulsa, who commented on our episode 443, and he refers to it as bottle of wine regarding antivirus. He says, at 18 minutes and 56 seconds, Bill says, you shouldn't have any real issues because like Windows exe file isn't going to do anything on your Linux. And George writes, unless you've installed Wine. He also references minute marker 40 minutes and 44 seconds. We mentioned Phil on Gaming in Lutris. It says, I downloaded pre-installed packages with .exe files. And George's comment is, there was a good chance Phil's EXE games would run because, per the Lutris FAQ, Lutris uses Wine to run Windows.exe files on Lutris. And he provides a link to an FAQ. He continues, I've used Wine to run commercial Windows software that's not listed on Wine's supported applications. That's why I presume someone could craft a malware.exe designed to run in Lutris via Lutris/Wine. Wine is not sandboxed, so a malware application running as an exe in Wine could affect not just the Wine instance, but the system itself. It is probably not a great risk, but it is a risk. The application, SandWine, can be used to mitigate the risk. It is free and open source. Here's a link. And we'll have that in the show notes, of course. Back to the antivirus, scanning an .exe file before running it in Wine, or anywhere for that matter, might identify if it is malware. That depends on whether it is in the industry standard database of known malware signatures on which ClamAV relies. The Arch Wiki offers a useful guide to how to use ClamAV, as well as how to add more malware signature sources to your installation. And George provides a link to that Arch Wiki guide, and we'll include that in the show notes too. So I think we knew all that, Bill. We just didn't mention it.
Yeah, it's highly unlikely that it would happen, but he is right. There is a chance it could, so I stand corrected. I will correct and say it's highly unlikely, but it could happen. How's that?
Yeah, if you think about it, someone would have to, because Windows and Linux are two different operating systems. They work very differently from one another, which is one of the reasons why natively .exe files won't run on Linux unless you have something like Wine or Lutris to make them, allow them to run. Because of that, somebody who would want to infect a Linux system in this way would have to write some malware for Windows that's an .exe file that then goes and launches some malware that they would have to write to infect the Linux system to be able to go and infect Linux with whatever it is they want to do. There are easier ways for somebody to write malware to go and get much more valuable information from corporate Windows installations. And the fact that there are so many steps in that and so little payoff, I don't think the risk is very large at all, as you said, Bill.
But yeah, like I said, to give him his due, George is right. It could happen. George, good catch.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah. So, technically, I could study up on Python and high-level computer language programming and begin a career to be a programmer, but that's not going to happen. It's highly unlikely.
So our next email comes from Phil, who asks about syncing with Google Drive. He says, "Hi, Bill and Larry. Greetings from replaceable subminion Phil in Iowa. I am running Pop OS and can't find a way to sync my home directory with Google Drive. I tried two programs and both weren't able to pass Google's authentication measures and therefore couldn't sign in. Any help would be appreciated. Thanks, Phil." I know from experience, I don't know if it's been updated or whatever, but I was never able to really get Google Drive to work nicely with Linux. So I don't know how that would. I'd have to look into it and see if anything's available or if they've updated it. You got any suggestions? I'm worthless on this one.
Well, I've run across a few. I haven't tried out any of them. What I did do, though, is I sent Phil a link that I'll include in the show notes to some Linux applications that purport to provide a way to sync to Google Drive. And like I said, I'll include it in the show notes. Haven't tried any of them, but my comment was, have you tried any of these, or were the ones you tried on this list? And, maybe there are some on there. Lots of different offerings out there. Can't vouch for any of them because I haven't tried them.
Yeah. I don't know what the answer is. I'll look into it and see if anything comes to the forefront. But right now I have no clue why or how you would do that but I'm sure there's a way.
Yep. And if anybody in our listening audience, if any of you know and have had experience with and like a solution that you're using, let us know and give us the pros and cons. We'd be interested in hearing, and I'm sure so would Phil.
Absolutely. Okay, Larry, I think that's all of it.
I think it is. Well, thanks, Sean, for making our work here easy by providing the voicemail. And I'm not sure how long this episode is going to be. Just us talking is an hour, so this might be a long one. It may fill in those gaps between, those longer gaps that we have these days between episodes. So you might want to break it up into different pieces and listen to it a little at a time. I don't know. Between Bill's job, my job, his new puppy, my new puppies, everything else going on in our lives, we have been fortunate to be able to put out a single episode every month. Once in a while, we may squeeze two into a month. We may get back to that sometime in the future, but I don't see that happening short term. Yeah. Yeah. We'll keep putting out episodes, though, as we can get them done.
But yeah.
as we've said, this is not a for-profit podcast that has sponsors to appease. So we get this done as we can.
And, you know, I can safely say, and I think Larry will agree, you'll never have to worry about listening to ads or sponsors, because we just do it because we love Linux and we want to share that. But anyway, we will try to get them a little more often, but right now we're coming, you know, we're getting ready to come into the busy holiday period, and and with everything, Larry has two of things, little puppies take care of. I only have one, so I don't know how he's doing it. One's enough for me. But yeah. We're not giving up. We're just recording when we can. Sometimes we're both like, I just can't record. I've got to go insert reasons.
Sleep
is good. Or
yes.
Or sick, or oh, hold on. You probably haven't heard anything from the puppies. I found out, Larry, that just give them treats and they go into treat comas for a little bit. So they're over here sleeping away, and I'm like, wow. That's what a revelation.
Yeah. So you just said you only have one new puppy, but you've got two dogs. One is a little older than a puppy, but still behaves like one from time to time, right?
From time to time, but I didn't realize how much he had grown up until I had gotten my new puppy's name's Cosmo. And so when Cosmo come along, I was like, puppies are a lot of work, because they don't understand the rules of the house, and so I've had to keep a close eye on him, because he will chew a cord, or he'll, if you don't let him out when he wants to go out to go to the bathroom, he sometimes doesn't want to wait. So, yes, my bigger dog, his name is Bear, has come a long way, and because I think Larry remembers he was kind of noisy at the beginning.
Yes.
Now he knows.
And he also was chewing on everything.
I know. But I keep swearing. I said, this is my last one. But no. Anyway.
No, that doesn't happen.
We'll continue
our puppy review on a future episode. And But for now, I think we have another episode coming up. It will probably be one in our Linux experience flavor, but we don't have a specific topic at this point. We will get you one, though. And until then, you can go to our website at goinglinux.com for articles and show notes, as well as links to download and subscribe. We provide the website for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done.
And if you like, you can participate directly with our friendly and helpful community members by joining discussion in our Going Linux podcast community on community.goinglinux.com.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.